This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This week, Joette Katz, Commissioner of the State Department of Children and Families, testified at a public hearing about recent reports about restraint, seclusion, and suicide prevention at Connecticut's two locked facilities for youth. In the last few weeks, her department has responded by changing policies and practices. Today, Where We Live, she joins us to discuss some of these changes. We'll also discuss the calls from advocates to close these facilities altogether. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joette Katz joins us in studio today. Welcome back to the program, Commissioner. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we wanted to get in a few moments to some of the changes that your department has made in response to some of these reports, a report that you put out and also another report from the Office of the Child Advocate. But first of all, I want to go back to Sarah Egan, who is the child advocate for the state, who was on our program recently. In her report, which went over about 18 months at CJTS and the Pueblo Unit for Girls, again, CJTS, for those who don't know the acronym, it's the Connecticut Juvenile Training School. She reports that youth were frequently exposed to violent takedowns by staff, restraints, long periods of seclusion, inadequate suicide prevention. Part of the finding was that the DCF had not fully reconciled the center's missions of correction and treatment. I'd like you first to just respond to what you saw in that report. How surprised were you by some of what you saw there?
Well, if I can just back up for a moment, because I have a CJTS advisory board, and last year, actually last fall, as a matter of fact, a couple of things came to my attention, and there were some concerns, more really about a culture shift that needed to take place, as well as some changes in practices. So we retained Dr. Robert Kinshoff, whom I understand is going to be calling in later, and who spoke at length yesterday. So I'm not dismissive of the OCA's report. I just want to be really clear that I don't wait for 18 months for a formal report to tell me what I need to know. If I can get to it sooner and I can get some more concrete data and information. So we retained Dr. Kinshoff, who did he can again describe for you himself, but he took 6 months and did a top down, up, inside out, you name it, and did a complete report for us identifying many of the things that he thought we could do quickly and then some things that are longer term. Then when I got the OCA's report, some of it was consistent. So some of it was really not a surprise, just in terms of the need for more therapeutic interventions, added clinical staff, elimination of prone restraints, which, by the way, we had been working on since 2013. Some of it, I will tell you, I don't agree with, and there's going to be an opportunity. I know there's going to be a hearing next week at the JJPOC. There will also be further legislative hearings, because I think when you take snippets of tapes, so let me just say, and obviously what we're going to do, and we're making these tapes available, but we want to black out the children's faces, and I also want to protect my staff. When you view these tapes in context, so you examine the 15 or 20 minutes preceding the snippet that has been shared publicly with the news media, I think you get a different perspective. So I just want to highlight that because I think it just put things in a different context, I should say.
Let's hear a little bit from Sarah Egan, the state child advocate. She came on our program just shortly after that report that she did came out. Let's listen to a little bit of what she said about getting emails of complaints from people inside the Connecticut Juvenile Training School.
Some of the concerns were complaints about management, but some of the concerns were raising pretty significant issues. One around inadequate training, two around inadequate suicide prevention, a couple around prolonged isolation. But there was a theme throughout several of these conversations, and it was that there are a cohort of kids in these facilities who have significant treatment needs that go unmet and that the folks working with these kids, i.e. the staff, need help to meet the needs of those children.
So I'd like you to address that specifically in whether or not you feel as though some of what she just said there is what you found. But first, I'd actually like to ask you about the complaints that she got. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when you retained Dr. Kinshoff to look at some of the same issues and prepare his report, I'm sure that you were dealing with some of the same complaints and some of the same type of information that the Office of Child Advocate got. But it seems as though there is a pattern of people from inside the facility reaching out to an external agency as opposed to reaching inside the department to remediate some of these issues. And I guess I'm wondering why that is.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I can tell you that some of the people who reached out are the ones, frankly, who have HR consequences and who have been involved with HR human resources because of their own behaviors. And so whether it's they're being proactive or being reactive, I think needs to be questioned. And what I mean by that in particular is, you know, the best defense is a good offense. And some of the people that with whom she spoke, and I have a very good sense of who they are, training is always an issue, and I completely agree. So I don't want to be defensive about this. I think it's really important to always talk about training, and I can tell you about all the new training initiatives that we hope to engage in and those that we continue to I want to be able to enhance. But to your question, the fact that a report came from inside in and of itself does not hold particular weight with me because it really depends upon who it is and what the nature of the complaint is.
So when you're saying that some of the people who are the complainants here, you say you might know well and they may have HR issues surrounding Correct. Their own employment. Are these HR issues surrounding restraint and seclusion, some of this very same acts that
Yes.
Sarah Egan is outlining?
Yes, and in fact, some of the complaints come from people who are actually the ones perpetrating the acts that she's complaining about.
Can I ask you the obvious next follow-up question, which is why do they still work there?
Well, and many of them have been subject to discipline. And there have been stipulations, there have been terminations, and then we've been forced to take some of them back. So, and again, I want to be really clear because I think the bulk of the staff are phenomenal and I really want to be supportive of them. But there are always outliers, just like in anything else. And I can tell you there have been a number of cases referred to HR and consequences taken. And in fact, some of the people have been it's much easier if someone's in a working test period and we're able to terminate them. That's a lot easier. If that's not the case, then we have to work with the unions and work with HR. And hopefully, if it's just an issue of training, I'm there. I'm really happy to do it. Sometimes it's a little bit more complicated than that.
I don't want to get too off track because there's a lot that I want to get to. But I will say that idea of outliers is interesting because in many ways, you and I have talked about the need or not for facilities like this for a while. Mm-hmm. And this has actually been a theme in Connecticut for years. Do we need locked facilities for youth? What's the best home for kids who maybe have violent backgrounds, but also have indeed been subjected themselves to terrible things in their past. And I'll just say that in many ways, these children are outliers, right? The system is large with many thousands of people involved, and we're talking about a couple dozen kids, boys and girls, but then we're talking about a couple, maybe handful of guards or others there who work at the facility who may be causing all the problems. And I guess I'm worried that these children who are in many ways outliers themselves in the larger system are then subject to whatever abuses may be at the hands of a few outliers that for some reason we can't extricate from the system.
So to your point, these are children, look, who no doubt have themselves been the subject of abuse, neglect. Their behavior problems really are the evidence of the own struggles that they've experienced. And they deserve everything that we can do to support them. There are about 10,000 kids who work their way through the juvenile justice system in any given year. Of those 10,000, 300 get committed to DCF, as adjudicated delinquents. And so to your point, yes, we are already now at 3%. And those are kids who have already had 3 to 5, on average, community service interventions that have not been successful. So why haven't they been successful? Well, again, the needs of the kids are sometimes enormous. Now you're down to 300. Of those 300, currently in CJTS in Puebla, we have 75 kids. Mm-hmm. So now you're down to 0.75%. And you're absolutely right. They are the most challenging. Their behaviors are the most challenging. And sometimes their needs are the greatest. So we need to do for them, and we need to make CJTS the most therapeutic facility that we can possibly do. Now, across the country, I am not aware of any state that does not have a secure facility, frankly. And so we talk about, well, do we need one large secure facility? Do we need 5 smaller ones? And I think everybody would agree CJTS is not the facility that we would build today if we were building. My job is not to decide whether or not CJTS stays or we disband and open 5-6 facilities. That's really a whole other conversation. But to the point about what we can do for these kids, so this is really where we have stepped up, I think stepped up our game, and we are going to continue to do that with under the guidance and tutelage of Dr. Kinshiff. And again, everything we do is inside outside. So we've eliminated prone restraints. We are doing a lot of more clinical interventions. We are working with the unions to increase the hours of our clinicians so that they will be there into the evening hours when kids often disrupt around visits, around phone calls, et cetera. Our training is we have a new – we have several – I mean we always did training, but we are really investing our resources in additional training, and we're doing it with line staff. So to your point, there's an integrated treatment model, and that was Dr. Kinshiff, one of his recommendations, that it not just be at the level of clinicians and supervisors or managers, but that it really get into line staff. And that's going to begin again in the fall, and then there's going to be follow-up aftercare. The work that we're doing with families, because again, most of these kids, hopefully, will be returning to their families, to their communities. And it's really important to help the families have the tools to be able to help the children manage their behaviors. So all of this, to the extent that her report, the OCA's report, is about additional training, additional supports around these children, I completely agree, and that's really where we're headed. If I can just add one other
thing. Please.
So, you know, some of it is a culture change. And we have done that throughout the system on the child protective side, what I call CPS side. So as a consequence of that, we have totally shifted our practice. Everything is around strengthening families' practice model, considered removals, teamings, and these are all initiatives that I've spoken about and I'm happy to address further. And as a consequence of that, we now have families at the table for everything. Our numbers are down dramatically. We have 17% kids fewer in care. We have 97% fewer children out of state, 60% fewer kids in congregate. We have tripled our numbers in terms of if kids can't be with their biological parents, they're with their relatives, their families. Believe me, when I tell you that that was a huge culture shift because the agency had been so risk-averse that we really had a lot of work to do with our outside providers because they had to shift their model too from a congregate setting to a really much more aftercare kind of setting and community-based settings, community-based services. We had a huge shift that we had to do on the CPS side, and we did it. And the numbers are incredibly successful. And I expect to do the same sort of culture shift here. And we will do it, and I have every faith and confidence that we will be able to do that to better meet the needs of these kids.
And I think the reason for my question, though, gets to, as you look seriously at this facility or these two facilities, and you see things that clearly are wrong, and you can specifically say, this is a behavior done by a person. Mm-hmm. All the culture change in the world, all of the practices, policies, and reports in the world probably don't go as far as making sure that someone who has acted inappropriately toward a child who's in the state's custody is no longer able to put his or her hands on a child. And I guess I'm trying to figure out what the barrier is to the identification and removal of those responsible for the worst, most egregious actions seen on the tapes.
So one of the things that we've done in response to all of this is, so in addition to outlawing, banning prone restraints, we now have mandated reporting procedures. So if any staff engages in a prone restraint, any staff, that's going to be an automatic call to the care line. It's going to get investigated. It's going to get referred to HR. It's going to get accepted, first of all. See, historically, part of the problem was the care line didn't accept reports if the staff followed policy and procedure and if there was no injury. Well, now we're not worried about whether there was an injury or not an injury. To your point, we're going to look at the behavior of the staff. So if the staff engages in a prone restraint, that's going to be an automatic call into the care line and it's going to be accepted. And if, in fact, it's not accepted, the head of the care line is going to be reviewing it, and I'm going to be reviewing it. That's going to change things dramatically. And then that's going to have SIU investigations looking at it, and it's going to also have HR consequences attendant to it. I want to be fair to people, though, because there's some things, obviously, we have our own obligation to do the training, to make sure that our staff have the tools. And that's part of what's going on here. It's not just about the prone restraints. It's really about also, let's say, seclusions. So we have been working on that. Now, to your point, outliers. For many of overall, I think the data that I heard – oh, here it is. I'm sorry – that I heard Bill Rosenbeck recite yesterday, in July, the average use of seclusion, the average amount of time was 1.58 hours. So that's 2 hours of putting a child, removing a child, and in his or her room. And why does that? Why do we do that? Well, we're only going to be doing it if, in fact, there's a risk of imminent danger. Now, sometimes this gets a little gray. There's no question about it, and it's about training our staff to anticipate and to try and do as much as they possibly can to diffuse the situation before it erupts. But to the point about how we shift our behavior. So that means I have to give my staff tools and training to be able to identify the dangerous or what their concerns are prior to them actually erupting. And so we're doing that. And in terms of HR, I mean, I want to be really careful. There are clearly staff, and this is true, I mean, this is true on the CPS side as well. There are some people who are just not cut out for this work. And we have to be able to deal with them. We have to be able to identify them, train them, and if they're not educable, so to speak, then we have to remove them. So you're right.
We were talking with Joette Katz. She's the commissioner of the State Department of Children and Families. We're talking about a few recent reports that have come out about the Connecticut Juvenile Training School and also the Pueblo Unit for Girls. There was a hearing yesterday at the state capitol, and more certainly to be done on this issue. We're happy to have her back in studio. We're going to be taking some of your calls in a few moments. You mentioned the videotapes and some of the context, perhaps, that you might be able to provide to this. I want to go back to Sarah Egan, the state child advocate, who was on our program talking about this report and talking about some of what she saw on videotape.
So I requested videotapes, and what I saw on those tapes, particularly from the girls' unit, I thought was shocking. Shocking and depicted dangerous conditions for youth. We saw children being repeatedly restrained to the floor. We saw a girl who was repeatedly prone restrained, which means restrained face down, whose treatment file had a medical alert that she'd not be restrained that way because of a respiratory condition. We saw the use of handcuffs and shackles. We saw a girl in extreme crisis and distress, being left in her room or cell, as you would call it, isolated with the door closed, who then would escalate it to hurting herself. We saw a depiction of blind spots in at least one girl's room who was found during that weekend in the corner with a ligature tied around her neck so tightly that a rescue tool was needed to cut it off. I looked at these things. I felt that they were absolutely depicted a unit that had some crisis issues.
So that's, again, Sarah Egan, the state child advocate, talking on our program recently. Obviously, you referenced this before. You saw some of these same videos and some of these same actions. What was your response, and do you have a slightly different take or different context for some of what you saw?
Well, so some of those tapes did result in HR consequences, and some of them, I think, require a larger context. And to the point about prone restraints, they've been eliminated. And she's absolutely right. And clearly when it's in a child's file, there's no question, particularly even prior to the elimination. If it's something in a child's file that says no prone restraints because of asthma, well, then there should be no prone restraints because of asthma. And that's what necessitated an HR consequence. One of the tapes that she's talking about involved a staff who was in a working test period and was removed. So I'm not going to say that there weren't some things that caused some concern and alarm, but I also want to be really clear that you have to look at things in a larger context. I think both from the child's behaviors. Again, you're talking about kids who are really at the very deep end. 70% of the children who come to us, we have no prior contact with. We've never seen them before, but we know that they have failed in 3 to 6, on average, other interventions in the communities. So their behaviors are going to be very challenging. And a lot of these kids, because of the traumas they've experienced, will dysregulate. There's no question about it. And their needs are going to be that much greater. You know, the problem is, getting back to one of your earlier questions about closing CJTS or not and why states have secure facilities – you know, you're talking about a very small number of children whose needs are immense. And as I indicated, we're down to now at CJTS 0.75%. We also have 19 community settings where we presently have children who have been adjudicated delinquent. So we do have those community-based settings. There's no question about it. But I think what most states have realized is you're talking about kids who are really on the deep end and their needs are great. And their behaviors are incredibly challenging. But that doesn't mean that we don't try and treat them. It just means that we have to recognize the challenge, and it means that I have to shift resources, which is always an issue, to support the staff who are dealing with these kids and working with them. We have the one good thing is, and I think Dr. Kinchiff identified this very clearly in his report, we have an incredibly robust educational program, vocational training. We have we are quite well staffed. The issue now really is extending some of the hours of those staff. So getting back to this restraint piece, okay, we have clinicians on staff. And they're there during the usual shifts. What we're going to be doing and working with the unions to do this is extend the hours. Right now, if a staff sees an issue, the staff can call the on-call clinician, and the clinician comes in. A lot of other facilities, they don't. They don't do that. A lot of hospitals don't. It all is done on the phone. We have our clinicians come in, but that's different than having the clinician there ab initio from the very beginning. And when our clinicians come, historically, they have held cameras sort of videotaping what's going on. Well, they're not going to be doing that anymore. Someone else is going to do that. They're going to be engaging. They're going to be practicing what they know and using their tools. And so that when a child has to go into, when the situation does erupt and a child has to go into a setting of seclusion, that clinician is also going to be able to take advantage of that time to really engage with the child, not just monitor, not just check in, but actually use that time for therapy to try and help the child get regulated.
One of the things, though, that I think has been a bit of a pattern, and it's interesting in this context because this is clearly something that is in the public conversation in America today when it comes to how police deal with suspects, how police deal with someone on the street, which is the use of force to enforce compliance as opposed to address an immediate safety threat. And when you and I have spoken in the past about the behavior issues of some of these children, it's quite clear to those of us who don't work in this setting that there may be indeed some safety issues, some behaviors that are very difficult to control. And I think all of us need to understand that. But some of the reports in either the Office of the Child Advocate report or in the past reports that we've heard from them suggest that some of the work that is done by those on staff are actually meant in some way to enforce compliance with a rule, compliance with a verbal command, as opposed to addressing a real safety threat. How have you addressed that specifically? Because obviously you can ban restraints or ban certain types of restraints. But at the end of the day, if you're holding down a child or doing something to a child just to get them to do what you want, that's a much different thing than keeping them safe or trying to control their behavior so they don't hurt others.
Absolutely. I mean, restraints are not to be used for behavior compliance. They are only restraints, seclusion are only to be used for imminent danger, an imminent risk that the child is going to hurt him or herself or somebody else. Now, sometimes that gets a little gray. So, and what do I mean by that? Well, it's sort of you see a situation erupt, and let's face it, it's not just about the child hurting him or herself. It's also about the child engaging in serious assaultive behavior with another child. And sometimes they're bringing their business from the streets, so to speak, and the gangs to the facility. And quite frankly, sometimes they do this in the facility because it's actually safer to do it because they know no harm will ultimately come to them because we'll intercede. So my question is always, and this is part of the training that they're going to have to really go through, and this is part of the culture shift. So at what point, though, do you have to wait for the first punch to be thrown? So that means that our staff have to get more involved with the clinical side of the child and have the child be part of the treatment plan. And that's what's going to happen. So when kids come in, we're going to do the ACEs study. We're going to examine what adverse child experiences they've had. We're going to do a CANS assessment. We are going to be doing all of that now from as part of the 30-day intake. And the reason that matters is that will teach the staff about the unique needs of this particular child. So rather than responding to children in general, they will know this child, they will know what behaviors will trigger this child, and they will know how to hopefully discourage those behaviors. Now, if it comes to the point where obviously they're not able to do that, well, then that's where restraints and seclusions really are going to have to come into play. But again, only around the question of serious, of imminent risk.
We have Dr. Kinchiff up on the line. We want to join him in a second right after our break. I just have to ask you one last question. Why is it just now that we're banning the use of prone restraints across the board?
Well, this has actually been a work in progress since 2013. just so you know. And Bill Rosenbeck testified to that yesterday when he started getting some additional training and asking for resources and looking at national best practices and models. And we just finally felt, OK, now we're ready. Let's just – this is it. The time has come.
We're talking with Joette Katz. She is the commissioner of the State Department of Children and Families. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Kinsherf, who put together a report for the DCF on the Connecticut Juvenile Training School and also the Pueblo Unit for Girls. We're going to take some of your calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, our guest is Joette Katz, the commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. We've been talking about a few recent reports about the state's two locked facilities for youth, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School for Boys, the Pueblo Unit for Girls. A few reports have come out, one from the DCF, one from the Office of Child Advocate. There was a series of testimonies yesterday at the Capitol, including from Joette Katz, the DCF commissioner. We're talking about some of the changes that are coming to her department and to these units. Today in the program, we're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. We're going to be talking with the doctor who helped to prepare a report for DCF in just a moment. But first, I want to get to Liz, who's calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Liz. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. It looks to me from this OCA report and the videotapes that there's a lot of abuse at CJTS in Pueblo. So my question is, why would you keep this failed approach going? Why are you keeping these facilities open?
Liz, thank you very much for the question. Commissioner?
Well, the approach to me, and as I began by talking about other states, I mean, even some of the states that have been touted recently in some of the reports the OCA has included, for example, Missouri, has seven secure facilities. And to my knowledge, there isn't a state in the country that doesn't have a secure facility. And it really is for the high-end kids. I don't believe in throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think there's a need. And if you don't, I mean, my goal is to reduce the number of children who need this kind of service. And obviously, if we do a good job working with them, they won't be back. And hopefully, we can continue to keep the flow from coming in. A year ago, we had 125 kids. We are down to 68 in CJTS. So, and can that number be decreased further? I'm sure it can be. But it's sort of like a bell curve. There will always be, in my mind anyway, there will always be a need, the smallest number as possible, but there will always be a need for children who really do need that high level of intervention. The question is that it really be a serious therapeutic intervention and not simply a warehousing. And that's been my approach across the system overall. I mean, there's 10%. I will tolerate 10% of our kids in a congregate setting. We're down to 13.9. When I came in, we were closer to 30%. Because, again, there's always going to be a need for children, whether it's on the CPS side or the JJ side, whose behaviors require it. And I think, at least in my mind, again, if you don't have some level of a secure facility, you put so much stress on the rest of the system.
But it's a lot of the criticism of the entire system has been about the facility itself. And I think you've referenced this in the past, that this is not the facility that we would build for children today. It's a facility we're stuck with. I think maybe to expand on Liz's question, yes, we might need a locked facility for children. If all states have them, probably that's something Connecticut needs too. But maybe vacating a facility that clearly was meant for a different use and does not meet the needs of anyone, including staff, you, kids, maybe it's time to, if you're going to throw some baby out with the bathwater, maybe it's time to get rid of the facility that shouldn't have been built in the first place.
So we all can agree that this is not the facility that we would build if we were building one today. And again, that's a decision that's really out of my hands. What I will tell you is in 2008, Governor Rell had this very same conversation, and she looked at what would it take to build five smaller such settings. And it was in 2008 dollars. It was going to cost $15 million to build each one. And it was going to cost $9 million to run each one, to a tune of $45 million a year in 2008 dollars. So again, that's a decision. Not only is it a moral and a philosophical decision, it's a fiscal decision. It's
how much does it cost to run the facilities now that you have?
Between $27 and $28 million for CJTS, as opposed to $45 million in 2008 dollars. And again, many of you remember what happened when we tried to do that in Bridgeport. on state property, and it was like that scene in Frankenstein, people lining up to protest. So again, these aren't my decisions, and that was using state property. Again, these are not my decisions, but I just point that out as it's not just a fiscal – it's not just a moral I think a philosophical discussion. It's also a fiscal one, and again, that's clearly out of my hands.
I want to get to one more call from Alex. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're in Wethersfield, and you're in Where We Live.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the taking away of prone restraints for staff. I work at a facility, not CJTS, that deals with very violent students, and I can attest that we used to go and do the prone restraint face down, and I understand some very zealous staff at other facilities have injured students. However, that particular restraint was very useful for us in a number of ways. Since moving on to our new restraint model in which the child is now standing up and no longer on the floor with the risk of being compressed, the student now can look us dead in the eye and spit in our faces. And so I understand that we moved away from one restraint for the child's well-being, but the staff well-being is not being taken into consideration either. We've had staff who have gotten broken eye sockets, noses, they've had to go through several months of blood screenings because due to HIPAA laws, we cannot know the background, the medical background of these children. So our families' lives are upset. We're upset. And in addition to that, we have to do a lot that's asked of us for a limited amount of money. Many people can make more money going into retail or selling anything rather than dealing with these children. We do this out of a need that we feel we can supply, but taking away tools from our toolbox in order to try to stop the problem of a few staff that you know, you can't get rid of or are unwilling to get rid of, and we don't know the reason why they've not gotten rid of them yet. But, you know, these restraints have been done numerous times to numerous children successfully.
Well, Alex, thank you. First of all, thank you for sharing that story, and it helps us understand a little bit more from the work that you do, so I really do appreciate it. I'd love for you to address some of this, Commissioner Katz, because here's someone who works in this field who says you're taking a tool out of his toolbox. This allows him to do his job to not potentially be injured on the job.
So thank you very much for not only for your call but for the work that you do, because it really is God's work. And I think to your point, nobody does this for the money. I mean, some of the children's needs are so huge, and you are really you are serving and for many of them really as a confidant and as a parent. So let me just begin by saying thank you. My role is, you know, when I look at the workers' comp claims, and we have a huge number of workers' comp claims, they're almost always linked to some form of restraint that's being utilized. And the worker gets hurt and the child gets hurt. And so my job, I understand I've taken away a tool that for you may have been useful, it's I've done it really as an abundance of caution, because I think too many children do get injured. I'm concerned about the children who have asthma. In the heat of the moment, we've seen it on video. We've seen the damage that can occur to these children. With regard to the spitting, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've seen a videotape where actually a child self-harmed, and by the time the staff got to the child, I mean, the child, there was blood. The staff threw himself in harm's way without knowing really anything about the child's status, and really just went in there to comfort the child and again, put himself in harm's way. My job, it's a balance. It's all a balance, and there's no perfect solution. And what I'm trying to do is hope that we can better equip our staff to really have the tools that they can do their jobs, do them well for the betterment of the children, and do them well for the safety of themselves.
I want to bring into our conversation Dr. Robert Kinscherf, who's senior associate at the National Center for Mental Health and Juvenile Justice and a former official in Massachusetts's juvenile court system and mental health agency. He's a consultant for DCF who prepared a report that we've been talking about. Dr. Kinscherf, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been hearing some of our conversations so far. What I'd like for you to do, perhaps, is outline why you were brought into this and what your reporting on these facilities found.
I was brought in December of 2014, this past December, to review policies and practices at the Connecticut Juvenile Training School and the nearby Pueblo Girls program, and to look at the components of the juvenile justice system operated by DCF in a national context to identify strengths and challenges and to offer policy, operational practice recommendations to address current needs while also helping DCF craft a strategic roadmap for reconfiguring and improving juvenile justice operations over the next 3 to 10 years and building upon the system that Connecticut has already committed to.
We've heard in a detailed form from Sarah Egan at the Office of Child Advocate, who prepared her own report, some of the shortcomings that she found at these facilities, which the DCF has already acted on. In your reporting, did you find many of the same things? How much do you feel as though the report that you gathered for the DCF diverged from the report that the Office of Child Advocate prepared?
I don't know that there was a great deal of divergence. I think that we both reports identified opportunities where changes could be made and practices improved. My report was broader. It looked across a range of policies and practices and was really intended to provide a platform for discussions about a variety of different policies and practices to either be built upon or implemented in coming years.
So from a broad standpoint, and this is what the last few callers were getting to in many ways, we want to try to address the question of what's a better system. So clearly, there have been some changes made, and I think that the commissioner has done a good job outlining some of the policy changes and HR changes that have already been made at these facilities. But from your expertise, Doctor, what do you see as a better outcome? I mean, what are we really looking at that would better serve the needs of this very small number of children in the state, something better than what they have right now at these two facilities?
Well, first let me put this in a little bit of context. Connecticut has come a very long way and is actually at the forefront of developing community-based services for youth involved in the delinquency system. Actually, of all the youth who are involved in the juvenile justice system, only a very small number of them get to DCF in the first place. Most of them are maintained in community settings, and an even smaller number get to the training school or to the Pueblo unit. Now, that being said, there have been a number of changes over the past year, which I think will improve practice, and there are other places we can go to try and improve practice further. So one of the strategic changes has been to drive down the length of stay and the number of admissions. We know that youth who are maintained in facilities-based care for prolonged periods of time actually increases their recidivism risk and makes it more difficult for them to integrate back into their communities. About a year ago, DCF created a presumptive 6-month length of stay for youth who go into the training school or the Pueblo unit or shorter. That will be helpful. We are also embarking on a process by which we more closely scrutinize the restraint and seclusion practices and more quickly identify youth who are failing to stabilize in the facility so that we can create alternative approaches to them that are very highly individualized. And there are also quite robust clinical resources there that we are organizing in a more sustained fashion to bring clinical expertise to bear more consistently and earlier, and especially for youth who are having trouble stabilizing at the facilities.
Commissioner Katz, I want to bring you back in because I think we've talked a lot about restraint, some about seclusion. Another finding of the Office of Child Advocate report had to do with suicide prevention, and there's a few aspects to this. I mean, one is I think the very clear reality that we've found over the years is that confinement of any sort, specifically solitary confinement, does increase the risk of self-harm. It increases the risk of suicidal tendencies. So how do we attempt to address that issue short-term and long-term? In the absence of sort of, a better facility, a more well-tuned facility for the sort of work that you're doing, it seems as though that's a big issue here that is a glaring part of not just this report, but a glaring part of youth incarceration as a whole in America today. It's the problem of kids hurting themselves and wanting to kill themselves after being in confinement for a certain amount of time.
So, you know, there's no easy fix because, again, think about the children who are coming to us. So I begin with that. We started in 2013 employing an evidence-based program called Shields of Care. We piloted it. We trained, I think, in 2014, 30 staff, and we've got refresher courses coming in 2015. We are contracting with an expert from UConn who is also used by Judicial Branch Court Support Services to assess not only our plant, our physical plant, but the clinical responses. We are asking youth to participate in planning for safe interventions in a crisis instead of having to resort to restraints and seclusions. We are going to be using multidisciplinary teams to improve the care and treatment for the youth who come in with known suicide gestures. Again, I would point out that 70% of the kids who come into us are unknown to us. So we have a lot of work to do up front very quickly, and that's going to be – part of that is also going to be the using the ACEs tool, the Adverse Childhood Experience tool. I heard Dr. Kinshoff talk about this yesterday. That's a challenge because for a lot of our kids, they don't view these experiences as adverse. They're just the norm. So it's going to take a little work to get them to open up, to talk to us, so that we have a better idea of who they are in that first 30 days. We are opening sensory rooms. We did one at Pueblo, and we're going to be taking – because our numbers are down, we're going to be taking some rooms with help of engineering. Everything has multiple facets. At CJTS to develop sensory rooms where children can go and help help self-regulate so that we don't have to resort to traditional seclusions. And it's all part of a process. And I would love to have a quick fix. I'd love to be able to say that I can undo 17 years of trauma in a 30-day assessment. I would be misleading if I told you that's the case. 60% of our kids, unlike years ago, not only are our numbers in half, but the ages of the children has increased dramatically because of Raise the Age, which is a really good thing. But 60% of our kids are 16 and older.
When you say Raise the Age, these are children that may have previously been in the adult prison system and now they're in a youth system.
Thank you. Correct. Yes. Yeah, so we have a lot of we have kids up to the age of 20. So 60% of them are 16 and above. And that means, frankly, that that's that many more years of trauma and patterns in their own lives that we have to help identify and address.
We're talking with Joette Katz, the DCF commissioner, also Robert Kinshoff, who is senior associate at the National Center for Mental Health and Juvenile Justice, who helped to prepare a report for DCF on these two locked facilities for youth. When we come back, a few more of your phone calls and finish our conversation here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. On tomorrow's show, a program that highlights some global music with local roots. We'll check in with the band Quiet Life, who has New London roots. They're back touring through America and here in Connecticut, and they're looking at a brand new record that's coming out soon. We'll also check in with Av Harris, a former WNPR reporter who recently traveled to Israel and sat down with Palestinian musician Wissam Morad. Hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking with Joette Katz, the DCF commissioner, and we're talking about the CJTS, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School, and the Pueblo Unit for Girls. Two recent reports coming out about these facilities. I want to get to a few more phone calls quickly. Sarah is calling. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question. So given that the commissioner, that you've admitted that CJTS is not your ideal facility, I was wondering if you would put a child that you love there. And if that question makes you hesitate, I wonder why it's okay for other children.
Sarah, thank you.
You know, you hope that a child never gets to the point of requiring a locked facility, whether it's CJTS or any other facility. I want to be clear, the kids that are there, and I don't want to demonize them at all, but I want to be really clear. These are children, it's almost like an antibiotics. You know, you try one, it doesn't work. You try another, it doesn't work. These children have gone through, on average, 3 to 5 community based interventions, and none has been successful. And so when we talk about the kinds of behaviors that get them there, the kids come into us from the court. And so obviously a judge is looking at them and saying, you know, we have to try something else. We really have to try something else. None of these standard interventions, no matter how innovative they are or how creative we've tried to be, none of them has worked. So now we're going to have to do this. We have an enormous amount of resources, I think, that we can bring to bear to help. Our educational facility is phenomenal. The vocational piece is also quite remarkable. And we've got the clinical staff. We need to step up our game. There's no question about it. But I put all of this in context because I think, look, even on the congregate side, I don't want any child outside a family. And I've put a huge amount of stress on my workers, and we've succeeded. And so now we have children, far more children with relatives, far more children with families, but there's a core number of children who cannot be safely maintained in a home. And this is the equivalent on the JJ side. I don't send them to me. They come through the court system. Where I do play a role, and I can tell you, is on children being readmitted. So any child who has gone through CJTS and is now back in the community, before a juvenile justice social worker can bring that child back into CJTS, they have to come through me. And they have to do a really good job of convincing me why the community is not able to handle the child, why the family's not able to handle the child, why we don't have the resources in the community to handle the child. And the kinds of behaviors I'm seeing exhibited by the children whom I agreed to bring back to CJTS, I can tell you, has really been startling. Sexual assault, assault on police officer, storing weapons in a home. I mean, I want to be really clear. I'm not trying to demonize the kids, but I want to be clear that these are not children that, you know, who are stealing apples off the back of a cart, particularly when we're readmitting them.
But as I think we've said, though, repeatedly, these are also children who themselves have been the victims of violent assault, sexual assault. These are people who have in part acted out because of extraordinary trauma that most of us thankfully would never have to endure. And so I guess I'm wondering, I mean, to the caller's question, it is very difficult to say, you know, would you put your own child in there? But is that one of the barriers? Is that one of the things that you need to look at? Is this a facility where you would put someone who is from your family to stay if they needed it?
Again, it's a last resort. Frankly, it's like a psychiatric hospital is a last resort. I mean, you hope to be able to meet the child's needs in a community-based setting, and you try and you try and you try. We are now talking about 0.75% of the children who come through the JJ system. And so would it be a first choice? Hardly. It is the last resort. It doesn't – but I want to be clear. We're not putting them there to warehouse them. We're not throwing them away. Our length of stay, even though they could be with us for far longer, even on the 4-year potential commitment on this for the serious juvenile offender, our average length of stay is 9 months. And for the other kids for whom it could be 18 months, it is 6 months. And that gives us enough time, we hope, to be able to really try and get them regulated, give them tools, set them up with therapy, start at the very beginning, and then have those have all of that continue into the community as part of the aftercare. So is it ideal? No. But you know what? We don't live in an ideal world.
We just have a few seconds left. Are you getting more resources from the state to be able to do the training, all of this change that you need? Because this clearly won't come for free. This is going to take some effort and money.
Well, we have been very successful, and because we've been able to reduce congregate care dollars, for every dollar that we have saved, we have been able to infuse 79 cents back into the community. So I quite frankly hope and have every expectation that we're going to be able to absorb this as we have to.
Joette Katz is the Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. Thank you once again for joining us on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our program today produced by our executive producer, Katie Tolarski. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Digital editor is Heather Brandon. Thank you so much for listening to Where We Live.